This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Elif Shafak is a novelist from Turkey, and she's also written about the unnerving political shifts of President Tayyip Erdogan's government. Just a few years ago, we saw Turkey as a more or less reliable, mostly democratic ally for the West, and a bulwark of stability in the Middle East. But the pressures on Turkey have become intolerable. There's a horrifying wave of terrorist attacks that seems almost unremitting. And most recently on New Year's Eve in Istanbul. There's a flood of refugees coming in all the time from Syria, and Erdogan's government at the same time has been steadily chipping away at the rights of Turkish citizens, and a coup attempt last year pushed the process into high gear. Erdogan has now jailed tens of thousands of civil servants and writers, anyone who might be seen as part of the opposition. Elif Shafak has had her own run-ins with Turkey's mandated nationalism. She was taken to court for the crime of what's called insulting Turkishness, because a character in one of her novels had lamented the Armenian genocide. She's been living in London, and that's where I caught up with her not long before the New Year's Eve attack. Elif, you seem to have the tension of Turkish society almost built into the dynamics of your family. You were born in Strasbourg in France, and your mother is an educated, secular woman, but your grandmother is entirely different. Can you tell me a little bit about that tension and fullness within your family?
Yeah, it was a very unusual childhood, if I may put it this way. I was born in Strasbourg in France because my father was pursuing his PhD in philosophy in France. And my mom, she was so young when she got married and she thought love was enough. So she had dropped out of university and followed him from Turkey to Strasbourg, and that's where I was born. But the marriage didn't live, and when the marriage collapsed and she came back to Turkey with me as a toddler in her arms, she had no money, no diploma, and no place to go to. And what happens to women in similar positions in Turkey is they immediately try to find her a suitable husband so that, you know, someone, a man, can take care of her and the child. But it was my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who interfered at this stage. And I'm talking about a woman who is not well-educated herself, who is more Eastern, more traditional, more superstitious, if you will. And she said, no, no, my daughter is going to go back to university. She should have a diploma. She should have a career. She should have choices in life. And in the meantime, I'm going to take care of my grandchild. And then my mom graduated with flying colors and she became a diplomat. And afterwards, she and I traveled a lot. So my early years in life, I called my grandma Anne, which means mother. And I called my own mother Abla, which means big sister. And it was a little bit unusual because they were very different. But there was a solidarity between these two women.
I read your novels with tremendous enjoyment and sheer storytelling, but I also see that, say, in Bastard of Istanbul, you take on the enormous subject of the Armenian genocide. In Honor, you talk about misogyny and honor killing in really deep ways. Would it be possible for you to live your life totally in Istanbul and write the same novels that you do?
I think it took me a while to make this confession to myself, but now that I have made it, I can make it to you as well. But you're right. I think had I lived in Turkey the entire time, I'm not sure I would have written the same novels in the same way. Also, it's not only a matter of geographical movement, but also a linguistic one. About 13 years ago, I stopped writing in Turkish first, and I started writing in English first. And ever since then, every single novel that I have written has been written in English first and then translated into Turkish. And then I took the Turkish translation and I rewrote it. So it was really an insane amount of work went into every one of these novels. But I did it because writing in another language somehow gave me a cognitive distance. I was able to look at Turkey more closely.
Elif, you are a writer of fiction, but lately you've been writing a lot about politics, and I sometimes feel it's almost despite yourself. You'd almost wish not to have to write about politics, but feel that it's an obligation. Why?
I think you're very right, because if you're a writer from wobbly geographies like Turkey, Egypt, Nigeria, Pakistan, if you come from such places, you do not have the luxury of being apolitical as a writer. If you care about what's happening outside your door, if you care about injustices, inequalities, other people's sorrows, the private space is also political. So politics is everywhere. It's diffused. Wherever power is, there is politics. So I have a much broader perspective on politics. And coming from a Turkish background, I do not have the luxury of being apolitical.
It seems to me that Erdogan has learned a lot from Vladimir Putin in Russia, many things. And one of them is that in modern Russia, journalism is completely controlled, particularly journalism on television, which is where most people get their news and their information, whereas literature is fairly free, certainly compared to Soviet times. You go into a bookstore and you can buy novels not only by Solzhenitsyn and all the dissidents of the Soviet period, but all the more dissident voices of contemporary Russia. You can buy these things, read them, and nobody bothers you. It's journalism where the oppression is. This seems to be the case in today's Turkey, that I can buy your novels in Ankara, but the journalism is where the repression is coming. Why is that? What calculation has Erdogan made?
It's very interesting. There are big similarities between Turkey and Russia, because people are usually thinking about the Middle East, given that Turkey is an overwhelmingly Muslim-majority country. Everybody always compares Turkey with the rest of the Middle East. But I think it's a better comparison to look at Russia and Turkey together. Of course, there are differences, but there are incredible similarities as well, historically, too. They were both empires, you know, multi-ethnic, multilingual empires. And they both have strong state traditions, and they both revere strong male leaders whom in some ways they see as the Baba, the patriarch of the society. And in both we find lots of conspiracy theories, paranoia that the outside world wants to destroy them. In Turkey, we grew up thinking, believing, because this is what we were told, that Turkey was a country surrounded by water on three sides and by enemies on four sides. So imagine when you grow up like that, what would be your take on international relations? What would be your approach to other people? So there's a lot of distrust of foreigners, xenophobia. Unfortunately, it's a very, very patriarchal country as well. The role of literature is quite interesting, and I think you have you've made a very strong point. Journalism is number one enemy, is regarded as number one enemy. And to be a journalist is the most difficult thing in Turkey. It's the most difficult profession in Turkey at the moment. Turkey has become the world's biggest jailer for journalists. There are over 140 journalists in prison today. Among them are editors, columnists, linguists, people of all backgrounds. And it's just unacceptable. I think we writers are feeling a lot of pressure, but we're not expressing it as much. And also there's a lot of self-censorship, which is a subject that we might not be talking about as much because it's a bit embarrassing, but it is the truth. There's a lot of self-censorship in Turkey among Turkish writers.
Elif, I remember being in Istanbul at about the time when Erdogan was just coming into power, and there wasn't yet that overall general anxiety about him as an autocrat or as a religious leader in some way. But what's happened with him? Why do we see him putting people in jail all the time, firing people by the hundreds and thousands from the civil service? Why has he turned the screws so hard?
Yes, I mean, Erdogan went through an enormous transformation, and along with him, the party itself, the AKP, the party in power, also underwent a huge transformation. We have to bear in mind that they came to power more than 13 years ago. And back then, it was, or it seemed, to be a different party. They came with different promises. If we remember the promises they made, it was pro-reform, pro-EU, and every time they would emphasize pluralistic liberal democracy. That discourse began to melt down. It began to shift gradually. It didn't happen overnight. But as the years went by, they became more and more authoritarian. So Erdogan became more and more authoritarian, and he also became more and more quarrelsome, and he also became more and more divisive, dividing half of the society against the other half and realizing that it works, that each time it brings him more votes. This is a very dangerous political game.
So there's a long tradition of coups in modern Turkey, 1960, 1971, 1980, and each coup was followed by a period of repression, deeper repression, and this happened in July, of course. And yet the liberal intelligentsia, which you're very much a part of, was very relieved to see the coup fail, despite its ambivalence for and even a deep dislike for Erdogan. Why was that the case?
I'm not a fan of the AKP. It's very clear that I'm not a fan of Erdogan at all. But at the end of the day, it's a government that has been elected. And the only way to change it is, again, through democratic means. The irony in Turkey is people who reacted to the putschists, to the plotters, the liberals, the democrats, these were the first people to be punished by the same government they tried to protect against the coup plotters. So the first thing that the government did when they started their purge was to suppress the intellectuals and the critical voices. And this is one of the saddest ironies of Turkey.
I found in Russia what happens in the bad old days and now sometimes again now is that most people are not incredibly strong. Most people don't have the capacity to stand up to all the things they'd have to stand up to. And they become weak and cynical, and they try to feed their families by whatever means they can because they can't fight the big fight of a truly great writer or a truly brave dissident. That time serving becomes the mode of getting along.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think there are, again, big similarities. For me, one of the most dangerous things is this anger. There's an uncontrolled amount of anger and frustration and unhappiness. And all of these things are toxic and they are contagious. We lost our culture of coexistence because of this enormous polarization. Everybody just constantly mistrusts each other. This is very sad. You know, we can't even unite in grief when there are terror attacks. Even in mourning, it's a society that cannot unite anymore. And that's very sad. There are big fractures in Turkey between Turks and Kurds, between people from different backgrounds. And everybody just wants to socialize with people who are exactly like them. That's not going to help us.
That sounds very familiar. That sounds very familiar to hear. And I wonder, you've lived in the United States quite a lot, in Arizona, in Boston, Michigan, at various times in your life. And I'm sure you paid attention to the recent election of Donald Trump. What did you make of it? And is there any way that you can compare it to how things are going in Turkey?
Absolutely. I find lots of similarities. I mean, I know many people in America tend to think that the Trump phenomenon is a singular issue, but it is not. There are lots of similarities with what's going on elsewhere in the world. And in Turkey, in Poland, in Hungary, in a different level, in Austria, now in France, in the Netherlands, than in the UK. We had the Brexit. What I'm trying to say is in country after country, we have observed the rise of isolationism, the retreat back into the nation state. There are huge similarities. And of course, there are similarities in the sense that facts are not important anymore. Statistics are not important anymore. Rhetoric is very important. The power of words. As a writer, I'm very interested in this. Populist demagogues, how can they connect so well with people? You know, I'm a very anxious creature myself. And when I see anxious people, I never belittle it. I think a lot about anxiety. And I think this is the age of anxiety. This is the age of angst. We need to understand this. Angst is not necessarily something that is created objectively or economically. It's mostly psychological. It's sometimes cultural. There's a widespread anxiety about the future, about immigrants, about refugees, about the other, whether their children will have the same job opportunities, etc. All these anxieties are valid and legitimate, and they cannot be belittled. The problem is, when nations are guided by fear, they make the worst mistakes in their history. And I'm very worried about that.
Elif Shafak is a Turkish writer who lives both in Istanbul and in London. She's the author of 10 novels, and you can find some of her essays about Turkish politics at newyorkerradio.org. You can also find a really interesting piece by Dexter Filkins about last summer's attempted coup in Turkey. It's definitely worth a read.